Les séminaires du Collège de France.
Bienvenue à tous et à toutes. Je suis content que vous ayez pu venir malgré le fait que la date est un petit peu exceptionnelle par rapport à l'ensemble du cycle du cours. Aujourd'hui, on a le grand plaisir d'avoir Nathan Goldman qui va nous donner un séminaire dont vous voyez le titre ici. Donc, il va nous parler en particulier des marqueurs topologiques dans le contexte avec interaction. Nathan est dans la maison, puisqu'il est même très familier avec le Collège de France, puisqu'il y a fait un post-doc il y a un peu plus d'une dizaine d'années dans l'équipe de Jean Dalibard. Et depuis quelques années, il est au CNRS, au laboratoire Kessler-Brossel, et son groupe de recherche, pour ce qui est de la partie parisienne, est implanté au même étage que notre groupe de recherche. Il est également professeur à l'Université libre de Bruxelles et chercheur à l'Institut Solvay. Nathan a un long passé de contributions remarquables dans le domaine de la topologie, en particulier avec les atomes froids. Il y a des séminaires de lui dans le contexte du cours de Jean, je crois, qui sont aussi très très bien. Il est en particulier l'auteur de cet article de 2014 que j'ai montré la dernière fois, dont j'ai montré la couverture la dernière fois avec Monica Heidelsberger, qui était la première évidence expérimentale du nombre de Chern dans les manips d'atomes froids. Voilà, je lui passe la parole pour le séminaire d'aujourd'hui.
And I suppose I have to switch to English. Is this correct?
Yeah,
perfect. Okay, very good. Well then, thank you very much, Antoine, for this very nice invitation. It's indeed a great pleasure to give a talk at home, as you said. And what I will do today is essentially build on some notions that you have introduced during your first two lectures, in particular the notion of the many-body Chern number, and try to build on this idea and show you more recent developments in the field. So there will be, if time is allowed, three parts. The part one will be a recap of what is this many-body Chern number, and we will try to look at this object from the viewpoint of a dichroic response. And this will allow me to review some results that we have obtained in the recent years in this framework. Then there will be a part number two, where I will try to introduce a many-body topological marker, so a marker of topology, which can be local, for many-body correlated systems, and which one could measure in an experiment from local ground state measurements, which is a kind of a provocation, but I will try to clarify what this actually means. And then, as I said, if time allows, I will discuss topological invariants built from single particle Green's functions. We will see that there are some very interesting anomalies which we have been exploring in this setting, both in the weakly and strongly interacting regimes. But let's start with part one, which will be kind of a recap and a review with a few recent results. So let's start with something that we've learned in Antoine's lecture, which is this notion of many-body Chern number. So the idea for today's talk is that what we have in mind is a 2D system of containing particles. So here I realize that this stick is a bit small, but yet I'm allowed to show you the system. So it's a 2D system with some particles, and it is described by some Hamiltonian H, and we will be interested in the ground state of this Hamiltonian, which I will call psi zero, with associated energy E zero. And in all the rest of the talk, we're going to assume that this state is actually gapped. And for the next few slides, we will even assume that this state is non-degenerate, and we will discuss the degenerate case in a second. Then, as Antoine explained, what we do is that we put this 2D system on a torus, and now we thread some fluxes along these directions. So there would be some flux theta x and some flux theta y, such that the Hamiltonian now depends on these two parameters, theta x and theta y. And so the eigenstates and eigenenergies also depend on these two parameters. Now there's a very interesting geometric structure, a fiber bundle, which appears in this structure, which Antoine also explains, which is represented here. So this torus here is now flux space, the space which is spanned by theta x and theta y. And at every point theta of this space, there is a fiber which describes the gauge or phase degree of freedom associated with my state. And now if I make a little walk in my parameter space, I can ask myself, how is the phase of my state changing as I do this little walk? And to answer this question, or this parallel transport problem, I introduce in this context a notion of a connection, which is a one form, which in this case is written as a Berry connection. So you see there's a derivative of the state psi zero with respect to the parameters theta x and theta y, and this defines a proper connection on this fiber bundle. Now, if I now ask myself, what is the Berry phase accumulated by my state as I perform a loop in flux space? Well, this Berry phase will be captured by a Berry curvature, which is related to the Berry connections components through these derivatives. So all these things were explained in Antoine lectures, which allows me to go quite fast. Now, because there's geometry, there are fiber bundles, that also means that there's gauges and gauge structures. And this was very nicely explained by Wu and Yang in this early paper of 1975, because these people tell you that the connection is nothing else than a gauge potential, and this was also highlighted in Antoine's lecture. The curvature it plays the role of a field strength. In 2D, this plays the role of a magnetic field, and we heard about this magnetic field in flux space in Antoine's lecture. But most interesting for us today, we see that when there's a monopole structure, so a topological defect associated with this field strength tensor, well, then there's necessarily some non-triviality in the fiber bundle that we have constructed, and this non-triviality is captured by the first Chern class. So it is natural to introduce this Chern number or this monopole charge associated with the curvature. So we saw that this Berry curvature has the physical interpretation of a magnetic field in flux space. So to calculate the monopole charge, we have to integrate this quantity here over the entire flux space, which is a 2 torus. And this defines now a many-body Chern number. Chern number, because this is a definition of the Chern number on this fiber bundle structure. And many-body, because I remind you that this Berry curvature is built from the many-body wave function. So here, as in Antoine's lecture, I have rewritten this Berry curvature in the following form. So this is a strict equality with respect to the previous definition. But here, notice the derivatives of H, the Hamiltonian, with respect to theta x and theta y. And I have introduced here a complete basis of eigenstates psi n, and therefore the sum over n different from zero, and En are the energies of these eigenstates. So this construction of the many-body Chern number was introduced by several authors which are listed here, Avron, Saylor, New, Thales, Wu, but also Tao in Haldane around the years of 85. Now, why do we care? Why do we care about this many-body Chern number? Well, as we saw in Antoine's lecture, we care because this topological invariant associated with the many-body wave function actually dictates the quantized values of the Hall conductivity in gapped 2D systems. Okay, so this is the celebrated Thales and co-authors formula that relates the Hall conductivity to this many-body Chern number. And here I will call this universal constant E square over H sigma not in the following. So this beautiful formula explains, if you want, or provide a topological interpretation for these plateaus that were observed in the 80s and 90s in 2D electron gases and strong magnetic fields, but also more recently in these fractional Chern insulators that can be produced without a magnetic field in twisted bilayer systems. Now, this connection between the many-body Chern number and the Hall response can be simply obtained through Kubo's formula, namely using linear response, and this was indeed nicely shown by Antoine in his first lecture. Here I would like to take a slightly different perspective and show you that we can actually relate this many-body Chern number very naturally to a circular dichroism, that is a dissipative response. So let me start with this little thought experiment. I remind you, we have a 2D system which we have put on the torus, and I told you that we are threading fluxes, theta x and theta y, through this torus, through these two different directions. Now the thought experiment that I have in mind is the following. Suppose that at time t equal to zero, I start in the ground state of my Hamiltonian without any flux. Okay, so I start in my ground state, in this gap ground state, and then at time t equal to zero, I now activate some fluxes along the x and y direction, and I choose this sort of circular modulation of the fluxes. Why do I use the word circular? Because you see that this actually corresponds to a circular motion in flux space. Okay, so the thought experiment is this. I start on my flux space at theta equal to zero, and I now stir my fluxes, right? I make little circles in flux space. And I do this with a certain frequency omega and a certain strength here, which is characterized by E, L will be the size of my system. And now you see I'm asking myself the following question. I have started in my ground state at time t equal to zero, and now I'm shaking, I'm stirring my system in flux space, so I can potentially excite my system and excite these psi n eigenstates. So the natural question that I can ask myself is, well, does this circular perturbation excite my system? And I can evaluate or answer this question in the limit where the strength of this modulation is sufficiently small. And the answer of that question is then directly provided by Fermi's golden rule. Okay, so gamma here would be the heating rate associated with the plus and minus orientation of these little circular motions that I'm doing in flux space. And what you recognize here is the usual Fermi's golden rule. There is a sum over all possible excited states. Here we recognize the initial ground state. And here we recognize the operator, which corresponds to the perturbation that I'm adding to my system upon changing this theta x and theta y flux. So you see that quite naturally, this dh over theta x and theta y, so the quantum geometry, if you want, of my system, enters this Fermi's golden rule. And here, this is just the Dirac distribution that tells us that the system initially in the ground state can absorb a photon h bar omega and jump to the state of energy En. So this is just Fermi's golden rule. And now you see the kind of the magic. If you now consider the differential rate, so gamma plus minus gamma minus. So if you ask yourself, do I heat up my system more if I do this motion in flux space or that motion in flux space? So if I take the difference and then integrate over all frequencies, what you get on the other side of the equation at the end of the day is actually the Berry curvature in flux space at zero flux. Okay, so you might recognize some structures here that were appearing in my definition here of my Berry curvature. Okay, you might wonder where is this factor here coming from? Well, it comes from this 1 over omega squared factor, which becomes En over E0 upon integration over the frequencies. Now, okay, we can relate this Berry curvature many-body curvature to this differential integrated rate. And now, if you consider the thermodynamic limit, you can show that this quantity, this Berry curvature, the Berry curvature does not depend on the fluxes, theta x and theta y, such that 2 pi f converges in the thermodynamic limit towards the many-body Chern number. And you thus obtain a very nice relation for the many-body Chern number in terms of this differential integrated rate. So you see that this dichroic framework provides a very natural view on what is this many-body Chern number in flux space in terms of a quantized dichroic response in flux space. Now, this is a thought experiment, but can you actually do this in a real experiment? Well, if you think about it, yes. How is this flux perturbation that I have introduced on the previous slide entering your Hamiltonian? Well, it enters quite naturally through the gauge potential, right? So if you want a flux theta x, which is 2EL over omega sine omega t, you just need to add this term to your gauge potential along the x direction. And indeed, the circulation of this gauge potential along the x direction will give you the flux that we saw on the previous slide, and similarly for the y component. So you see that this little experiment that I was doing by threading time-dependent fluxes on my torus simply corresponds to acting on my system with a circularly polarized electric field. Okay, so this is now very physical. You can picture a very simple experiment. You take a material, a 2D material, you irradiate with circularly polarized light, and you measure excitation rates. And this should give you the many-body Chern number of your many-body state. And this led us to this proposal that we introduced in the context of ultra-cold atoms. Here we replace, if you want, the circularly polarized electric field by a circular shaking of the optical lattice. So the experiment that we proposed was, let's put our fermions on an optical lattice, let's prepare the particles in the lowest band, which could potentially have some non-trivial Chern number, let's now shake this optical lattice circularly and measure how many particles are actually leaving this band over time, right? So we would then extract these heating rates gamma for both plus and minus orientation of the shaking of your lattice. And then you would reproduce this experiment for many frequencies omega. So you would extract these curves, gamma plus of omega and gamma minus of omega. And then what we saw previously is that if you take the difference between these two curves and integrate over omega, you get your many-body Chern number. And it turns out that this quantized circular dichroic experiment was first realized in ultra-cold atoms. It was realized in Hamburg in the lab of Klaus Sengstock and Christoph Weitenberg. And here is a picture of the gamma plus and gamma minus as a function of omega that were extracted in this experiment by exactly counting how many particles were leaving the lowest band, which is something that you can deduce from such band mapping images. Essentially, counting how many atoms you have in these regions tell you how many atoms you have in the lowest band, and counting how many atoms you have in this region tells you how many atoms ended up in the upper bands upon linear, upon circular shaking. And in that experiment, they could indeed verify this quantized circular dichroic response for the very first time. Now we have established this relation between the many-body churn number and this differential integrated rate, just using Fermi's golden rule. But now what is the relation to the whole response? The whole response seems to be absent in this story. It's actually not. It's here in disguise. It's actually hidden in the differential integrated rate through this relation, which is actually just Kramer's chronic relations. Might take a few seconds to think about it, and we can discuss it more after the talk, but this is actually just Kramer's chronic relations. And now you see that there's an interesting thing. If you now combine Kramer's chronic relations with this Fermi golden rule expression, you actually obtain that the quantized whole response, that is sigma h divided by e squared over h, is actually given by the many-body churn number. So you see that this is a very simple proof of the topological quantization of the whole conductivity in gap 2D system, which only uses Fermi golden rule and Kramer's chronic relation. So this is a little story that we told in this paper with my friend Tomoki Ozawa, in this paper which also celebrates the gold medal of Jean Dalibard a few years ago. Okay, so what about fractional quantum Hall states? If you have a fractional quantum Hall state, your ground state is degenerate. That means that instead of having a psi zero, you actually have a multiplet of states. You might have up to, let's say, d states. D would be the degeneracy. And in that case, you can still build a fiber bundle structure. It's a bit more complicated. There are some non-abelian structures that appear. But you can still think about parallel transport, which will be dictated in this case by this non-abelian Berry connection. So you see some indices here, A and B, that refer to the indices of this multiplet, such that the Berry connection is now matrix valued. So because the connection is matrix valued, the curvature is also matrix valued. But if you look in your math book, you will see that such fiber bundles will still be described by a churn number, a first churn number, which is simply obtained by taking the integral over your base space, or your flux space in this case, of the trace of this matrix. Okay, so the churn number naturally appears. And note that this churn number is still an integer. Okay. Now we have to be a bit careful, because in the condensed matter physics community, there is a standard notation which is used by most people, which is to actually define the many-body churn number of fractional quantum Hall states as the churn number so defined, which is this integer, divided by the ground state degeneracy d, such that this many-body churn number so defined is actually a fractional number. So we have to be a bit careful, but this is the notation or the convention that I will use. And why do we introduce that object? Well, because you can relate the fractionally quantized whole response to this fractionally quantized many-body churn number that includes the ground state degeneracy. And that was discussed and proven in particular in these two papers by Niu Thales Wu and Tao and Haldane. Now, This idea that a fractional response appears in the whole response naturally translates to the circular dichroism framework. And this is something that we have shown explicitly with Cécile Replin a few years ago. So we have considered a fractional churn insulator, and we have analyzed the dichroic response of such fractional churn insulators and verified that indeed the differential integrated rate in that case led to a fractionally quantized response. So this was an experiment which was done numerically, of course, and I believe it was never shown explicitly in experiments. Now there's an interesting twist in this story, which has to do with edge effects. All the things that I've been telling you until now are purely bulk. Okay, but now if you think about the edge of fractional quantum Hall states is always interesting because there are some chiral modes propagating, and these modes are gapless. Okay, you have a chiral metal on the edge of your system. And now if you think about the dichroic response of such settings, you will realize that, sure, there is this dichroic response in the bulk. Here I'm showing you gamma plus minus gamma minus as a function of omega. This is the bulk response which we have been discussing until now and whose integration will give you the many-body Chern number. But it turns out that if you have a system with an edge, think about a quantum Hall droplet, the edge will actually also contribute to the dichroic response, but with a minus sign. That is, the edge will exactly cancel the bulk response. Now, this has a very beautiful corollary, which means that if you now measure the dichroic response only locally on the edge, right, you do some local dichroic response, you inject angular momentum on the edge, you can actually infer the many-body Chern number of your system. So it's a way of thinking about the bulk edge correspondence, if you want. And now there's another very appealing aspect, which is that the edge response is entirely captured by low-energy effective edge theories, the so-called chiral Luttinger liquid theory introduced by Wen. So theoretically, it's very appealing that you can actually extract this fractionally quantized response from a completely universal low-energy theory, which is this chiral Luttinger liquid theory. So it's both appealing from the theoretical point of view, but also from the experimental point of view, because that means that you can extract these topological invariants, many-body topological invariants, from a local edge response of the system. And this is something that we have explored considering many integer and fractional quantum Hall states, together with Noor Unal and Alberto Nardin in this recent paper that appeared just a few months ago. Okay, I will close part one, but I just would like to flash and briefly mention other applications of this dichroic approach, which goes beyond the Chern number. So let me do this very briefly. The first thing that I would like to mention is something that we realized in this paper that we wrote together with Tomoki Ozawa many years ago now, where we realized that by modifying the way that we were modulating the system, we could not only extract the Berry curvature and the Chern number, but we could actually extract the full quantum geometric tensor. And so this provides a completely universal way for extracting the quantum metric and Berry curvature in essentially any kind of system. The only thing you have to do is identify the proper parameter space, shake in a certain way, measure excitation rates, and you can extract the full quantum geometric tensor. And it turns out that it's this method that led to the very first measurement of the full quantum geometric tensor in the lab of Jianmin Cai in Wuhan a couple of years ago, who plays with NV centers. So these are solid state qubits. And so here you see the first measurements of all the components of the quantum metric and the Berry curvature. So this was actually performed in many different experiments, superconducting qubits, also in cold atoms in the lab of Sengstock and Christoph Weitenberg. I would like to insist on the generality of this approach by flashing this result here, which is an experiment result which was obtained in the group of Paola Capellaro at MIT, where they extracted, using this same method, a higher form curvature, so a three-form curvature, which is associated with a tensor monopole. A tensor monopole is a monopole, a topological defect that lives in four dimensions that was introduced in string theory. And what we show is that this method allows us to extract this three-form curvature and the associated topological invariant, which is not a Chern number. In that case, it's a Dixmier-Douady invariant, which was extracted in that experiment, all, again, using this method. So it's very general and very useful. More recently, we have been applying this dichroic approach to bosonic excitations, in particular together with Baptiste Bermond and Anaïs de Fossé, who are present in the room today. We have explored the possibility of exciting magnets using some driven dissipative protocol in a way that these magnonic excitations uniformly occupy a Chern band. So now this is a Chern band of magnonic excitations in an interacting spin system. And once this steady state is constructed, we can then use some rotating magnetic field gradients to apply some dichroic probe and measure this Chern number. And this again is very appealing because in these magnonic systems, we typically probe edge excitations, and it's pretty difficult to have access to the bulk topology. And this is, again, a method which would allow us to directly probe the churn number of magnetic excitations locally in interacting spin systems. And I cannot resist showing you this very recent paper that appeared just last week in PRB as an editor's suggestion. Here, what we have done is generalize these dichroic probes to a thermal context. So essentially, what we're doing here is we consider chiral thermoelectric probes. So these are probes that couple to the heat current in your system, not the electric current, but to the heat current. And in that case, we find that this framework allows us to obtain some rules for the orbital and heat magnetizations, some rules which were lacking previously by when people were only considering the electric response, if you want. So this is a very interesting framework, which also leads to interesting quantum geometric structure. We have identified this heat quantum metric, which, in contrast with the usual quantum metric, is not defined over this flux space that we have discussed, but which is instead defined over a space of gravitomagnetic deformations, which is a rather abstract context, but a concept which I'm happy to discuss after the talk, if you're interested. This, again, is a work led by Baptiste Bermond, Lucila Peralta-Gavinsky, and Anaïs de Fossé, which now brings me to part number two. Part number two will be about a work which we have done with Felix Palm, Alex Inpertro, and Monica Eidelsberger. And here the idea is to find a way to extract this many-body churn number locally in a system, but without perturbing it. So this is essentially the key question that we are addressing here. Is it possible to extract the local Hall response of the system without measuring a response to a perturbation? If you think about the standard Hall response, you either apply an electric field, or in the dichroic framework, you might want to shake it. If you know the Streda formula, you apply a magnetic perturbation. So here the question is, could we measure this local many-body churn number by performing local ground state measurements? And so, in order to address this question, the idea is to go back to the Kubo formula that Antoine introduced in his talk. So you see here, I'm writing the local Hall response, sigma h as a function of r. R is a position, for example, on a lattice. And we can see this object as the DC limit of this optical Hall conductivity, which is essentially this Fourier transform of this unequal time current-current correlation function, which is indicated here, right? So you see here we have the imaginary part of an expectation value over the ground state of these currents Jx, Jy at different positions and different times. Now, this is a beautiful object, but it's a terrible object to measure in an experiment. If you think about quantum engineered systems that have access to local currents, how would you actually measure these unequal time current-current correlations? Now, in this context, there's an interesting hypothesis that you could make, and that I will justify in a second, which is to suppose that this unequal time correlator can be simply expressed in the following way. So implicitly, what I'm saying here is that I have a gap 2D system whose optical Hall conductivity has a resonance at a very well frequency, a characteristic gap, for instance, in the system, which I call omega zero. We still have to identify what is this omega zero, but in the limit of Landau levels, we anticipate that this would correspond to the cyclotron gap, right? Because only transitions from the lowest Landau level to the next contribute to the optical Hall conductivity. So I'm introducing this characteristic frequency omega zero in this ansatz, and I'm also introducing this broadening gamma, which would indeed describe a broadening of this single transition from the ground state to excited states, contributing to the optical Hall conductivity. Now you see that if this ansatz works, then I have essentially simplified the problem hugely, because I have replaced the problem of measuring unequal time correlators to a problem of measuring equal time current-current correlations, which is something that people can measure in experiments. Now, if you believe in this ansatz, then within this framework, you see that we have a very elegant form for this local Hall response, right? I'm just inserting this ansatz into that equation here, and you see that sigma h of r, which is indeed the local many-body churn number in a gap 2D system, can be simply expressed in terms of this equal time current-current correlator times this factor, which includes this characteristic energy omega zero and the broadening gamma. So you see, it's a way of expressing this local churn marker in terms of just three parameters, this correlator, omega zero, and gamma. Now let me show you a plot which kind of validates this idea. Here, this is a little numerical experiment using a non-interacting churn insulator. We will see strongly correlated states in a second. So here, for the specialist, I'm considering a Hofstadter model, and we present the extracted churn marker as a function of the flux in this Hofstadter model. What you see on the plot here above is this unequal time correlator calculated exactly in the system, so that would be the blue curve. And what I'm showing here is a fit of this blue curve using this one frequency ansatz that we saw on the previous slide. And so using this fit, I can extract these three parameters, and I can inject that in this formula and get a value for this local churn marker. And what you see is that this approach actually works extremely well, at least if you consider fluxes here which are not too large. For the specialist, again, we know that when the fluxes are sufficiently low, the system actually converges towards the continuum where the Hofstadter bands become flat Landau levels, and this is indeed the limit where the single frequency ansatz is actually exact. Okay, so this is nice. The single frequency ansatz seems to work, and we will further comment on this later. But we would like now to introduce a general approach to extract these parameters. This equal time correlator, this omega zero, which is a priori unknown, and this broadening gamma. And why not try to understand how to get the complete correlator CR of t. Now, the method is pretty simple. We just make use of this usual expansion, right, for a product of operators involving some exponentials. And the idea is simply to inject this exponential in the expression for this unequal time correlator. Here I have explicitly used this Heisenberg representation for jx of t. And now you see that by using this expansion, we can represent CR of t in terms of an expansion, right, which now involves some powers of the time t. Okay, so this is another way of writing things. I can write my unequal time correlator as an expansion in powers of t, and now the entire information is contained in these coefficients, which I'm calling Cm, right, and which are defined by the following expression. So what you should recognize here is essentially a correlator of jx with some m-fold commutators of h, the system Hamiltonian, with the current operator jy. So this is already kind of appealing because you see that this unequal time correlator can be entirely extracted from purely static ground state observables, right? So these are expectation values of static quantities in the ground state. Good, so this is the result that we have. But you see there's a terrible sum, m going from zero to the infinity. So we have to truncate this, and I have to justify why we can truncate this expansion. And the intuition is that for these gap 2D systems, there should be a finite space-time region where these correlations are relevant. So what I have in mind is that I have an insulating phase of matter, so I have a finite correlation length. We have typically short-range interactions in the system that we consider. So there's a finite correlation spreading velocity. So altogether, the intuition tells us that we can make this hypothesis of only looking at the early time behavior of this quantity. So I'm limiting myself to essentially these three first terms going up to the quadratic form t squared. And you see that this early time expansion is actually totally compatible with this single frequency ansatz that I have introduced before. And now we can actually connect the three parameters that we had before. This equal time correlator CR of zero is, well, by definition, C zero. I just take zero here. This is by definition the equal time correlator. But then perhaps less trivial, we see that the broadening is given by C1 divided by C0. And this characteristic gap or frequency omega zero is given by this non-trivial expression involving C0, C1, and C2. So again, within this framework, we see that we can obtain the local churn marker entirely from few static ground state observables, in this case the coefficients C0, C1, C2 obtained from that expression. Okay, so this is now a mathematical expression. In practice, how would you extract C0, C1, C2 in an experiment? Yes, Nicolas, you have a question? That's a good question. I thought about it many times, but never actually did it. Yes. But that's obviously an interesting thing, because you see that you can relate the churn marker, well, the correlator CR0 to the churn number times the gap squared or something like this. I've never done that calculation explicitly, but it should be the case. So in practice, how do you extract C0, C1, C2? Well, to calculate these objects, you have to give me a model, okay? So of course I will choose one of my favorite models, the Hofstadter model, in which I can have both churn insulators and fractional churn insulators. So I will just include this Hofstadter model Hamiltonian here in this M-fold commutator expression. Now, to make a long story short, what do you find? You find something really remarkable, which is that the CMs can be obtained by a sum of further range current expectation values. So no longer correlations of currents, actual current expectation values. So this is shown pictorially here. If you want to extract C0, all you have to do in your experiment is measure these four currents here. If you want to extract C1, you have to extract all the currents indicated here. There are 32 currents, if I remember well. And here, if you want C2, you have to measure all these, if I remember, 256 currents, which means that in order to extract the three relevant parameters, C0, C1, C2, well, this would require 292 ground state currents. Seems a lot, but you could do this in parallel in a large optical lattice, and it doesn't seem to be too frightening, at least according to Monica and Alex. So here we are using Kubo. There is no assumption on any translational invariance. It's completely general. We actually did these calculations for junctions, where you have a quantum Hall state of churn number 1 and a churn number 2, and you can calculate all these things locally, and you will see that you have a 1 here and a 2 here. So there is no assumption beyond the fact that you have a gapped 2D system. Okay, very good. So here's a bit of numerics. This is again for a churn insulator of non-interacting fermions filling the lowest band of the Hofstadter model. This is done in a box with 13 times 13 lattice sites. And I show you the local churn marker that we would extract from C0, C1, C2. So please look at the green dots. And the orange dot. So this is obtained by extracting C0, C1, C2. You can actually get rid of C1, and you see that you get a very similar result. So this broadening gamma is not so relevant, at least in this limit of small flux alpha. And you see that the result can be further improved by adding more and more coefficients. So for example, if you add C4, you see that you get an even better result. Of course, C4 is terrible. You would have to measure thousands of currents, but okay, it's interesting to see how these things sort of improve. It's also interesting to see to what extent this single frequency ansatz is valid in this system. Let's look at this plot. I find it very insightful. What I'm showing you as these dotted line here as a function of alpha is the flux in my Hofstadter model, is the usual continuum limit value for the cyclotron gap. Okay, so the cyclotron gap goes linearly with magnetic flux. Now, what I'm showing you with little crosses here, this is the actual value of the single particle gap in the system. Okay, and you see that as a function of flux, here you see that this nicely converges towards the continuum limit. Okay, and now what you see is that the omega zero, which I have extracted from my C0, C1, C2 coefficients, very, very nicely fit or match an energy difference between first band and second band in the Hofstadter model. So this has a nice consequence, because that means that if you then believe that omega zero is nothing else than the single particle gap in your problem, and that gamma simply corresponds to the bandwidth of your spectrum, which is something that we validate here, then you see that in order to extract the local churn marker, the only coefficient that you have to measure is actually C0. Okay, so suppose that you can measure this from some simple spectroscopy, then the only thing that you have to measure to extract this local churn marker is this equal time current-current correlator, which, as I showed you on the previous slide, just requires four local currents. Okay, so this is very appealing now from an experimental point of view. The only thing that you have to measure, in fact, are these four currents, which I think you see the answer to your question is essentially here, right? So you see that this deviation from the single particle gap and what we actually measure becomes more and more important as the bands become more dispersive. What I have in mind is that if you have something like a Dirac model, like a Haldane model, where the Berry curvature is again very well localized, then all this should again work very well because you would again have a very clear frequency, associated with a single transition. Here, in this regime, you know, when alpha is of the order of 1/3, the Berry curvature is a bit crazy in your brilliant zone. And so this leads to a breakdown of this method. Yes, this is indeed an important point. Okay, let me just end this part by showing you the results for a strongly correlated fractional churn insulator. So this is again considering this Hofstadter model, but now considering hardcore bosons. So these are very strongly correlated bosons in the Hofstadter model. I consider a filling of 1/2. So we expect a Laughlin state nu equals 1/2 in this system. And here I'm showing you the result of this local churn marker as extracted from the local current, so from the coefficient C0, C1, and C2, as a function of the number of particles. And what we do is that we increase the system size as we increase the number of particles to keep the filling factor fixed. And what you see is that the method doesn't work so well for a very small number of bosons, but as you reach 8, 9, 10, you start to see some convergence towards the value 1/2, which is indeed the expected churn number for Laughlin 1/2. Okay, so you want me to compare the scale associated with essentially what I have here in C2 with the size of my quantum hole droplet.
Or the correlation.
Okay, it's quasi-local. Okay, I think it's very clear that there is a notion, it was a bit implicit everywhere in my previous slides, there is a notion of a correlation length because we have a gap system, and indeed the gap above my Laughlin state will establish this correlation length. And if this, well, for the Hofstadter model, as you know, the correlation length will be of the order of a few lattice sites, right? Because the gap is, let's say, a tenth of J, the Hopping matrix element. So you would need, what, 5, 10 lattice sites, right? And okay, this seems to be more local than this, but again, I mean, it's of the same order. Yeah, yes. No, I agree. I agree. I agree on this point. Yes. But again, we have verified by making junctions, we have access to different many-body churn markers on either side of, and in that sense, it's local.
And when you're getting close to the edge?
I know, of course. No, that's terrible. You have to be far. No, this is bulk physics again. Yes. No, we don't want to see the metallic edges here. That would be terrible. Yes, I agree. Okay, so the end of the story here is that indeed we can extract this local churn marker by performing these quasi-local static ground state current measurements, which ends part two. I'm looking at the time. Do I still have 15 minutes? Yes. Cool, so I can relax a little bit and switch to a completely different, but well, not completely different topic, but which is perhaps something a bit more conceptual and abstract, which is this idea of building topological invariants starting from single particle Green's function, right? So a single particle Green's function is essentially the propagator, which tells you what happens to a single electron which is injected into your system. In our case, it will be a fractional churn insulator or a strongly correlated topological state. So we are asking ourselves, what is the fate of this electron injected and interacting with this topological background? And to what extent this single electron knows about the topology of this strongly correlated system? Okay, so this is the definition of a single particle Green's function of a many-body system. So what you see in this expression is basically what I just said. You create an electron at some position and time, and then you remove it at some other position and other time, and you evaluate this little operation on your many-body state. So here you can consider the Fourier representation of this object. So you have G that now depends on omega, the frequency, and we will represent this GRR prime as a matrix G of omega. Now, this single particle Green's function, as you know probably in this room, captures many interesting properties of many body potentially correlated systems. In particular, a simple observable that we will consider is the particle density. The particle density is essentially directly given by the Green's function at equal position in the limit of equal time. Now, there are topological invariants that you can build from that object. The simplest one is simply to realize that G of omega is a map from the omega axis onto the group of invertible matrices, right? And so the simplest homotopic number that you can build associated with this map from omega to G of omega is this winding number here. So there's an integral over omega trace of G minus 1 dG over G omega, and this is an integer, okay? And we will call this object N1 of G. This is very nicely introduced in this paper by Seki and Yunoki. So that's a topological invariant. You can build another topological invariant if you have translational invariants. Now G depends on omega and also on K, the quasi-momenta. We are still in 2D, so we have Kx, Ky, and now we have essentially three parameters for G. We have Kx, Ky, and omega, the frequency. And now considering this 3D space, and again, the map from the 3D space to the group of invertible matrices, you can build this homotopic number, which is N3, which is a higher order winding number, which you see involves derivatives of G with respect to Kx, Ky, and omega. And this is, again, an integer, and this is an integer which is known as the Volovic or Ishikawa and Matsuyama invariant. So these are topological numbers. Are there any physical meanings associated with these objects? Well, there is a very simple result, which is Luttinger's theorem. Luttinger's theorem tells you that N1, so defined, so this integer topological invariant, is actually nothing else than the total number of particles in your system. So that's nice. You have a system, you have N particles, N is a topological invariant. It's kind of interesting. And this topological interpretation of Luttinger's theorem is, again, very nicely explained in this paper. So there is a physical meaning associated with N1. Now, as many people know in this audience, in particular people like Michel and Georges, this Luttinger theorem can be violated. It's in fact not a theorem, and it does so in the regime of strong correlations. For experts in the audience, this typically appears when the Green's functions develop zeros, in which case the total number of particles in your system is indeed given by this N1 of G, this is the Luttinger theorem, plus a correction, and this correction now explicitly involves the self-energy, which contains all the information of the interactions in your system. So what about N3? N3 is this beautiful object here, and it was in fact proposed and shown by Ishikawa and Matsuyama and then by other authors that this N3 object is in fact the quantized whole response. Okay, so there is a way of writing the quantization of the whole conductivity entirely in terms of the single particle Green's function, conveying this idea that a single electron injected in a quantum whole state knows about the many-body Chern number. So this is extremely appealing, especially for theorists, because this is a very nice object that we'd like to manipulate. But unfortunately, it was shown by several people, I'm just listing a reference here, that this is not always the case. There are situations where there is a breakdown of this Ishikawa and Matsuyama theorem. Sigma H is not given by N3. There are clearly some corrections. Now, if you're a bit careful, this is already obvious for fractional quantum whole states. In a fractional quantum whole state, we know that sigma h should be quantized according to a fractional number, let's say one-third for Laughlin state at thing one-third, whereas I told you that N3 is an integer. So of course, this equality cannot hold in the regime of fractional quantum whole states. Okay, so one way of addressing this sort of dilemma, this tension, so what is the connection between these two things? What we propose to do is to use a completely non-perturbative argument, which is provided by the so-called Streda formula. And let me just show you, if you're not familiar with the Streda formula, it's probably the most beautiful formula in physics. As you will see in a second. No, it is so. So the Streda formula can be derived by just considering these notions here. Maxwell's equation, the fact that we have an insulating state of matter, and the continuity equation of charge. The little experiment that you should do in your mind is the following. You have your quantum Hall droplet. This is this thing here. And now let's insert a small magnetic perturbation in the droplet. Now we use Maxwell's equation. This magnetic perturbation creates an electric field. Now because we have an insulating state of matter, this electric field E generates a current which is strictly transverse to the electric field. Because there is a current, there has to be a change in the particle density in the bulk. And now you see, by just staring at this equation, that the change of particle density should be directly related to the change of magnetic field in my system through a single coefficient, which is sigma h. It's the only thing that appears in these equations. So indeed, this is the relation, dn over dt is given by db over dt, through a single coefficient, which is sigma h over ec. And you see there's no assumption about weak interactions or absence of disorder or anything. It's completely thermodynamic in general. And so you see that by massaging this equation, what you have is that the whole response expressed in this quantized form, so sigma h divided by e square over h, is just given by the variation of the particle density with respect to a variation in the magnetic field. This is the so-called Streda-Widom formula, which is written here, and which is perhaps the most fundamental aspect of topological matter, because from this formula you can derive in two lines that whenever there is a Chern number in the bulk, there has to be conducting edge modes on the edge of your system. This is the so-called Streda anomaly, which I will not explain now because I don't have the time to do so. But it's extremely important and beautiful. So what we do is essentially start from this Streda non-perturbative approach. And now what we're going to plug in is this expression for the total number of particle n, now expressed in terms of Luttinger's theorem, n1 of g, plus its correction, the so-called Luttinger integral. So you see the calculation now consists in calculating the response of the Luttinger theorem to a magnetic flux and the response of this correction. And what you find, this is a beautiful calculation performed by Lucila, is that indeed, the variation or the variation of N1, so the variation of Luttinger's theorem with respect to a flux perturbation, is actually equal to N3, which through Streda's formula rigorously shows you that whenever Luttinger's theorem is valid, the quantized Hall response has to be given by the Ishikawa-Matsuyama invariant. And if there is a breakdown of Luttinger's theorem, then we know, we understand why there is a breakdown of the Ishikawa-Matsuyama invariant or theorem. Because in that case, we see, again from this equation here, that the quantized Hall response is given by N3, this is this result, plus a correction, but which we can now write explicitly. It's the variation of the Luttinger integral with respect to a flux perturbation, a quantity that we will call delta N3. And now, let me just, I will be done in just a few minutes, but let's just ask ourselves a few questions. What is the physical and topological nature of these delta N3? Right? We know that there are these zeros of Green's function that lead to a breakdown of Luttinger's theorem, but are there any physical, you know, observables or effects that we can associate with these Green's function zeros and who would ultimately explain what is the physical content of this delta N3? This is a very fundamental question that people are still addressing today. What is the topological meaning of this delta N3? Right? We know that this quantity here is quantized according to a fractional number. N3 has to be an integer, so there has to be some fractions hidden in this dn2 over d5. What are these fractions? So these are questions that are still unresolved. And the thing that we decided to do was to evaluate these quantities exactly, so this N3, delta N3, in a regime of strong interactions in the fractional quantum Hall regime, where we know that this quantity has to be quantized according to a fractional number. So I will end with this. This is a numerical study performed by Anton Markov and Andrei Nikishin. What they considered is a fractional churn insulator in the Hofstadter model of non-interacting fermions at filling one-third, so it's a Laughlin-type state, which they have calculated or analyzed exactly using exact diagonalization. And here what they did, the tour de force, was really to extract these Green's functions and build all these objects from the Green's functions that they extracted from these ED calculations. So these are the details of the calculation. So on the Hofstadter model, they consider 6 fermions, nearest neighbor interactions, a small box, 10 times 11 sites. The flux per plaquette is fixed in this experiment. And if you're an expert, you realize that for this filling factor, the density should be of 1 over 15th. So let me show you the densities. Okay, so this would be the total density in this little box that they would extract by computing N1 plus N2, right, which they calculated separately. And this indeed shows you a little plateau here at a value close to 1 over 15th. So the experiment, the numerical experiment, is doing what it should. Here we calculate the relative deviation of this with respect to the actual density in the system, and we see that this is relatively small, 10 to the minus 3, so things seem to be working well. And here are the results for the individual N1 and N2. So N1, I remind you, this is Luttinger's theorem. This is the correction to Luttinger's theorem. And you see that the density predicted by Luttinger is actually 1/5. So again, if you're an expert and a bit careful, that means that according to Luttinger, we have completely filled the lowest band of the Hofstadter model, which is of course not what is happening because this is the real density, but this is what the Luttinger theorem is predicting. And this would be the correction to the Luttinger theorem, which of course allows you to recover the actual density in your system. So this is about the particle density and the Luttinger theorem. So what about the strata response, right? We're thinking about extracting N3 and delta N3. And again, here I'm showing you the total strata response. So this is the response of N1 plus N2 with respect to a magnetic perturbation. This is supposed to give us the many-body churn number, and indeed we have something close to 1/3. So things seem to be under control. Again, there's an error of the order of 10 minus 3, so we're good. And now let's look at the individual strata response. This is the strata response of N1, right? So this is N3. And we see that N3 shows a very nice plateau at the value of 1. So this is now an exact evaluation of N3 in a fractional churn insulator. And we see that the correction, delta N3, or dN2 over dB, gives us a minus 2/3 to recover the actual 1/3, which is the exact strata response. So this is quite interesting. It's an exact result, which we can now compare to predictions that were performed in the past or formulated in the past, in particular by Victor Gurari, who estimated these kind of numbers through some effective theories, in particular edge theories. And we show here a disagreement with what they had predicted, which actually hints towards a better way of analyzing these topological Green's function effects using edge theories. So this is now something that we would have to explore. There are many things that we now understand with this N3 of G in terms of the underlying single particle churn number and single particle Berry curvature, but I will not discuss this today. And with this, I thank you for your attention. I, of course, acknowledge these people who work with me on all these topics. And let me highlight for today's talk Felix Palm, Anton Markov, Andrei Nikishin, Lucila Peralta-Gavinsky, and of course also Anaïs and Baptiste, who are in the audience. And I thank you very much for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.